Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
David Grand is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he's the best-selling author of The Lost City of Z, about legendary British explorer Percy Fawcett and his quest to find a lost civilization in the Amazon rainforest. It is now a major motion picture. They never come out as a minor motion picture. I don't know why. But that's terrific. Congratulations. He's written for many top American publications. He's a winner of the prestigious George Polk Award and many other honors. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
So the first thing I want to ask is about the start of the story. It starts in Kansas in the early 1870s.
Yes.
And it involves the Osage Indians. What happens in Kansas that forces them to relocate?
Yeah, so the Osage Indians had been driven off much of their land across the Midwest and bunched up and confined to a reservation in Kansas in the 1860s and 70s. They were under siege once more from white settlers, and there was a massacre. And at that point, an Osage chief stood up, and they needed to find a new homeland. And he said, we should go to this land in what was then Indian territory and would later become Oklahoma. We should go there because it's rocky, it's infertile, and the white man won't be able to farm, and he'll finally leave us alone. So my people will be happy in this land. And there's actually a record of his speech. And so that's where they decided to go. And they actually purchased the land. They had a deed, and they migrated to this territory that was about the size of Delaware. And by that time, the forced migrations had taken a tremendous toll on them. They had dwindled to just a few thousand.
And when they got to this new place in Oklahoma, how did it come about that? I mean, I don't mean to minimize it, but it's almost the Beverly Hillbillies, where they look down in a stream and see the bubbling crude coming up.
Yeah. So one day in the 1890s, an Osage Indian was over looking at a creek, and he saw a rainbow sheen on the water. And he showed it to a white trader at the time, and they realized it was petroleum. But at that time, they thought there was just a little bit under the land. They had no idea that they were, at that point, sitting upon some of the largest deposits of oil then in the United States.
Well, how did they find that out?
So there's a very curious thing happened, which is that the Osage tribe was allotted. And what that meant is that the reservation was broken up. And this happened to American Indian nations across the country. It was a way for the U.S. government to end the communal way of life and turn American Indians into private property owners, which was also a way, not incidentally, to make it easier to procure their land. When this happened, the Osage inserted in their agreement a very curious provision, which said, we will maintain all the subsurface mineral rights. And because they had a deed to their land, they had more leverage. And nobody thought they were sitting on a lot of oil. And so they managed to hold on to this last part of territory that they could not even see. And so when the tribe was then allotted, the Osage became the world's first underground reservation. They controlled everything underneath the land. And by the early 1900s, prospectors were coming in and discovering these deposits. And by the 1920s, the Osage had become the wealthiest people per capita in the world.
We'll get to that in a minute. There was a place called the Million Dollar Elm.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, there was a fellow from Minneapolis named George Getty.
Yes, yes, that is exactly right. Many of the great oil barons of the day first made their fortune in the Osage, including the Getty family. J.P. Getty would describe going there as a little boy and traveling onto the Osage reservation where they had leased a lot and struck oil. And there was such demand for the oil under the Osage territory that they would hold these public auctions. And everybody would gather the people like Getty and E.W. Marlin and Harry Sinclair, they would arrive on these private railroad cars. They would all gather under this tree where the biddings for leases would rise into the millions. And thus, this tree became known as the Million Dollar Elm.
When they did this bidding, were the Indian people getting what they deserved? Were they making the amount of money that they should have been? Or was the fix in early on?
You know, they were probably not getting the full amount that they should have, but they were certainly becoming extraordinarily wealthy. They were able to, on these leases, get a single lease could go for as much as $1 million or $2 million, and they were collecting royalties. Early on, when there was just a little while, they would be collecting a few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars a year. But by the 1920s, these 2,000 or so Osage had accumulated millions and millions of dollars. In 1923 alone, they accumulated collectively what would be worth today more than $400 million.
Divided up among?
Just about 2,000.
And so what did they do with the money?
They lived in terracotta mansions. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 cars. They had servants, many of whom were white. Now, this caused a great deal of fascination with the rest of white America and the public. Reporters would travel out to Osage territory and tantalize the readers with these stories of the quote-unquote red millionaires and the quote-unquote plutocratic Osage and the fact that there were white servants doing the work. This all belied longstanding stereotypes of Native Americans that traced all the way back to the first brutal contact with whites.
What did the arrival of this bounty do to the sort of tribal communal way that they had been living before?
The Osage spoke at that time of often being unmoored from their traditions, not just from the wealth, but from the fact that that wealth drew in so many settlers. I mean, these became wild boom towns that drew in outlaws, New York money men, oil barons. And so there was a lot more intermarriage. There was a lot more intermingling of traditions at that point. So a lot of the old ways were being lost during that period.
Let's fast forward to May of 1921. Which, if my math is correct, is about 96 years ago.
Yes.
And we meet...
I'll trust you on that.
I hope my calculator was right. And we meet a character named, or you introduce us to a character named Molly Burkhart. Yeah. Tell us about her.
So Molly's really an astonishing woman. In many ways, she is someone who straddles not only two centuries, she was born in the 1880s, but straddles two civilizations. She was born in a lodge, which is like a wigwam, speaking Osage, practicing Osage traditions. She was then uprooted because the federal government required that she go to a boarding school, a Catholic boarding school, at the age of 8. Within a few decades, she's living in a mansion, and she has white servants, and she's married to a white settler from Texas named Ernest Burkhart, and she is speaking English. So she, in many ways, embodies... this transformation of the country that is happening. And, of course, in 1921, she and her family then become a prime target of what would become a really nefarious murder conspiracy.
How did that murder conspiracy first come to light? Was it a nationally known story at the time, or was it a local affair?
It was a local affair. So in 1921 in May... Molly had an older sister, she was even less than a year older than her. She was 34 at the time. Her name was Anna Brown. And one day, Anna visited Molly's house. That evening, she went home, and the next day, she disappeared. And Molly looked everywhere for her. She had friends look for her. And a week later, Anna's body was found in a ravine. She had been shot in the back of the head. And it was the first hint that her family was a target, and the first hint, at least, that the tribe was also a target. At that time, it was not a national known scandal at all. A few weeks later, Molly's mother, who was one of the last of these kind of Osage elders who still practice all the old traditions, grew mysteriously sick. She almost seemed to wither and become more insubstantial. Molly tended to her. She actually lived in the house with Molly. And within 2 months, she died, and evidence later revealed that she had died of what was suspected to be poisoning. Not long after that, Molly had another sister named Rita. And Rita was so afraid when these killings were taking place. They had lived in the prairie out in the countryside. They had moved closer to town to be near Molly. And one night at about 3 a.m. in the morning, Molly woke up. She heard a loud explosion. The force was so powerful that people in hotels nearby were thrown off their bed, windows shattered. Molly got up and she looked out the window, And in the distance where her sister's house had been, all she could see was this orange fireball. It looked like the sun had burst into the night, and where her sister's house had once been was gone. Somebody had planted a bomb under it, detonating it, killing her sister's husband, and a white maid who lived in the house. Even then, it was still largely known locally, but among the Osage at that point, it had become what was known as the Osage Reign of Terror.
I'm Stephen Smith. You're listening to The Thread live from the Fitzgerald Theater with David Gran, author of Killers of the Flower Moon, the book that we're talking about. So it wasn't just Molly and her family that were targeted.
No. I mean, her family was most conspicuous because so many died within a short span. But no, others were being targeted. There was a champion steer roper at the time, an Osage, very well, very fit, a young man. He got a call one night. He left his house, came back to his house, dropped dead, frothing at the mouth. Evidence later revealed that he had died of what was believed to have been strychnine, which is a just horrific poison. Often you see it in novels because it's just such a horrific way to kill someone. Your whole body convulses as if with electricity. You're conscious while you're dying until you finally suffocate. Another man who was close to Molly, a man named Henry Roan, was found shot in the back of his head. The Osage were being systematically targeted. It was not just Molly Burkhart's family.
Let's talk about the context of policing at the time. So you've got people who are apparently being poisoned. You've got people who are being shot in the back of the head. Who's the local law?
Yeah.
Is it reservation law?
No. There was some, but for the most part, all these crimes would have fallen under the jurisdiction of white authorities. The most prime legal figure in the area would have been the sheriff. And the problem back then, and one of the shocking things I learned when I did research for the story, was just how lawless this country was back then, particularly in a place like Osage County, which was really the last remnant of the Wild West.
This is the early 1920s, yeah. And we're talking Prohibition era.
Exactly. It was, and there was a great deal of outlaws. There was also an enormous amount of corruption at that time. If you were powerful, you could buy the law. You could tilt the scales of justice. The other problem was a lot of local lawmen just didn't have much training or experience. So going back to the strychnine, poisoning became one of the prime modes of killing the Osage because it was easy to slip somebody a poison and there was no local crime lab or anyone who would have done a toxicology, even though the science was known back then, but nobody was doing it. So it was a very easy way to commit murder and get away with it.
In fact, there were inquests, right?
There were inquests.
This is a process that we don't use anymore.
Yes.
Maybe refresh people's
memories. Yeah, so an inquest would often have, there would be a local person who would be put in charge of the inquest. They would call a couple doctors. They would have some jurors who would gather. Those would just be citizens.
And they'd go to the site of the...
Go to the site and they would look and kind of gather evidence, but the people kind of conscripted had no training and they would, you know, ask questions. They were usually always men in this case and always white men, which is important in a case like this because the victims were Osage. What happens in many of these cases, evidence seemed to disappear. It begins to become clear as these murders go on for a couple years with nobody doing anything about them. There is obviously corruption, there's incompetence, and there's a great deal of prejudice that causes the white power structure, white authorities, to neglect these crimes. Somebody like Molly Burkhart crusades very valiantly for justice, often putting a bullseye right on her while she's doing this.
Let's talk a little bit about the context of attitudes, both in Oklahoma and nationally, about Native American people. As you mentioned, it's a time when the government, the federal government, has a explicit ambition to use boarding schools, either federally run or church-run boarding schools, to eliminate Indian culture. They banned people speaking their own language, the children, et cetera. And you mentioned the allotment process, which is a way of breaking things up. How in Oklahoma and the U.S., what was the view of the Native American?
There was a systematic campaign of assimilation that was often very brutal. And I tell the story of Molly Burkhart, who at the age of 7 is suddenly uprooted from her family, her community, the center of her world, put in basically the back of a wagon, taken far away from home than she's ever been, put into a boarding school. She has to remove her blanket. She's no longer supposed to speak Osage. She has to speak English. She's given a Bible. She's trying to be taught a whole new worldview, and has to being forced to shed her culture. Allotment was obviously a way to end the communal way of life for the Osage and other American Indian nations. The prejudice at the time was overwhelming. Often Native Americans were, when you read these government records, you're just shocked by the callousness, the indifference, and the stereotypes. And even when the Osage came into all their money, it became manifest in a very crude way, these prejudices. Suddenly, the federal government would hold these hearings at Congress in which white congressmen and senators would sit around the room and debate, what are we going to do about these Osage with all this money, as if somehow they were children? And they would even use that word, children. And they somehow couldn't handle their money, like as if the great Gatsby and Fitzgerald were all handling their money so well. But somehow the Osage were scapegoated. And you read it in the literature. It's just astonishing. And you can read it in magazines and publications, as if the money wasn't rightfully their own, as if they couldn't handle their money. There was I found a statement from an Osage chief who said, this is an injustice. You know, we're not children. And they even passed legislation requiring that many Osage have white guardians to manage their wealth. This system was deeply racist. It was literally based on the quantum of Osage blood. If you were a full-blooded Osage like Molly Burkhart, you were deemed incompetent by the U.S. government automatically, and you were given a white guardian. And not only was this a racist system, it also led to a criminal enterprise in which many of these guardians swindle money.
I mean, we should also mention that this is, in the 1920s, this is still a period where, say, for the last 120 years, the idea of scientific racism has existed. And so that adds, I mean, that gives us some understanding, if you can expand on that, of why someone who was full-blooded would be viewed as less competent as somebody who had some admixture of white blood.
Exactly. They were literally seen as somehow genetically, physically inferior, mentally inferior. And it's, you know, if you read congressional records and just listen to the debates about their money, this is just abundantly clear. And it led to this outrageous system of this guardianship, as if the hand of enlightenment, the veneer of enlightenment often concealed the fist of coercion. And that's what comes across when you read those records.
And this will be crucial in the sort of unraveling of this story. So law enforcement, federal law enforcement gets involved. There's a place called the Bureau of Investigation in the Treasury Department, later becomes the FBI. And there's a young man with not a whole lot of experience named J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, yes. Yeah, hard to believe. One of the more interesting things about this story is seeing J. Edgar Hoover in his kind of early days. He was only 29 in 1924 when he became acting director. And he gets this case. And the Bureau, in many ways, was this kind of ragtag operation. It had been created about 15 years earlier, but it was this ragtag group. It had agents. They didn't have the power of arrest. They had very limited jurisdiction. They didn't have jurisdiction over murders. They weren't supposed to carry guns. The few murders they had jurisdiction over were on Indian reservations, which is why this case fell to the Bureau. And the Bureau had just been amidst its own oil corruption scandal of Teapot Dome, in which there was bribes, in which agents were concealing evidence, a Watergate-like cover-up. So the Bureau was this kind of oddly stained institution when Hoover took over it. And when he got the when he became director, they began purging some of the ranks and hiring these kind of more college-educated agents, but they have almost no criminal experience. And the Bureau initially badly bungles the Osage murder investigation. This is, I should state, this is among the first of their first major homicide cases. And just to give an example, for 2 years they got the case in 1923. The Osage Tribal Council had issued a resolution pleading for federal authorities to step in, and the Bureau made no arrest for 2 years. Not only that, they got an outlaw, a guy named Blackie, who they hoped to use as an informant, and they got him out of jail. He quickly slipped their tail. He robbed a bank, and he killed a police officer. And so Hoover is sitting in Washington. Now, this is the part that's hard to imagine. Hoover was insecure about his power. He was new to the job. He feared that another scandal might end his career. And so that's where the second investigation picks up in this case.
And Hoover would be afraid of scandal tarnishing the Bureau until his very final days.
Yeah.
And
you see all the seeds of his character, the paranoia, the megalomania, the fear of scandal. It is all there right in the beginning.
But he doesn't turn to a college guy. He turns to a Texas Ranger, an old-style lawman.
Yes, he turns to a guy named Tom White, who in many ways is like Molly Burkhart, somebody who straddled two centuries and in many ways reflects the transformation that the country is going through as it becomes a more modern nation. He was born on the frontier in Texas around the same period that Molly was. He grew up in a log cabin. He was from his own tribe, a frontier lawman. His father was a frontier lawman. He was a lawman at a time when justice was meted out by the barrel of a gun. By the time he is summoned to Washington in 1925 by Hoover, not yet sure why Hoover is summoning him, but to take over the Osage case, he's wearing a fedora and he's got a suit. He has to file paperwork, which he can't stand, and he's trying to adapt the modern methods of scientific detection, such as fingerprinting and ballistic analysis.
Right, and so this again is this sort of merging of science with practice, because the idea of professionalism of scientific analysis is hitting a lot of different professions at that time. Turns out that the ballistics analysis didn't actually work out that well.
That's very true.
In the long run, you can't really tell what gun has fired something by the marks on it. But anyway, they were pretty excited about it at the time. So what does Tom White do?
So obviously Tom White does not fully reflect the kind of agent Hoover was hiring, but he knew that none of his men who he was hiring had actually had any criminal experience. So he turns it over to White, who was known as one of the cowboys. And Hoover had kept in the Bureau at that time a handful of these cowboys because they knew the frontier and they were the only ones with actual real criminal experience. White, recognizing the danger, recognizing the corruption, decides to put together an undercover team. And just to give you a little bit of context about the danger, several people before the Bureau got involved who had tried to catch the killers had been killed. White folks. A lawyer who tried to gather evidence was thrown off a speeding train. Another man had gone all the way to Washington, D.C. to talk to the feds to see if they could get involved. He checked into a boarding house. He received a telegram that night that said, be careful. He carried with him just a Bible and a pistol. That evening when he left the boarding house, he was abducted. A plastic bag was wrapped around his head. He was found the next morning in a culvert, and he had been beaten to death and stabbed more than 20 times. And the Washington Post, at that time, was the first time it really became national, sadly because it was probably a white person being killed, and said conspiracy to kill rich Indians. And so Tom White, when he gets involved, knows the danger that exists. And so he puts together an undercover team of these frontier lawmen. And
They all show up in this kind of remote part of the country?
Yes.
Wouldn't people kind of be on to the fact that these guys are rolling in and newcomers?
The fact that this area drew so many newcomers and migrants at the time, there were so many cowboys showing up, the oil money had drew in so many roustabouts that yes and no. They posed as cattlemen, and there were a lot of white cattlemen arriving in the area. What was very interesting was Tom White also hired an American Indian agent. And there are no statistics at the time, but I think it's fair to say that in Hoover's bureau, he was the only American Indian agent. And he joins the team as well.
He's not an Osage, though.
He is not Osage, no. And they all assume these undercover roles. One sells insurance policies. He had actually once been an insurance man in real life. He sells insurance and actual policies. But getting to your question, they begin to be followed as well. And so clearly people do eventually become suspicious of them.
The investigation begins to focus on a man who's known as the King of the Osage Hills. Who's he?
So his name is the King of the Osage Hills is a man named William Hale, who showed up in Osage territory at the turn of the century, like a man with no discernible past. He was dirt poor and wearing rags, riding on a horse, carrying a Bible. And he then slowly began to buy up land and become a cattle baron. And by the 1920s, he is a deputy sheriff. He is deeply politically connected. He is seen as a benefactor who donates to charities and builds institutions. He's this kind of great booster. And he has become the most powerful figure in the community. And he was known as the King of the Osage Hills. One other important point is he was also Molly's husband's uncle.
Molly's husband's uncle. So Molly's husband is a white man.
Is also came from Texas. He had actually first moved to Osage County because his uncle was there to work for the King of the Osage Hills. And he sometimes worked as a chauffeur. And he was actually chauffeuring Molly around, which is how they met. Yes, they are both Texans, both outsiders. And that's the man Molly married, was his nephew.
So Tom White is trying to work down this story. How does it break?
Well, the investigation has many twists and turns, and in many ways it was less like a criminal investigation than an espionage case. There are double agents, there are moles, the reports are being leaked. They often don't know who in the authorities are working with them, who of their informants are helping them or betraying them. There was even a triple agent. But ultimately, they follow the money. And in following the money, it leads them to the very people who is targeting Molly's family are the people who she thought loved her and loved her family.
Including?
Her own husband and the King of the Osage Hills. And what makes these crimes so sinister is that they were deeply intimate. What was happening is Hale had directed his nephew to marry into the family so that he could inherit the oil money. And there was a wrinkle that I should have explained a little bit earlier, which is that when the Osage created that mineral trust, each of those 2,000 or so Osage was given what was called a head right. And a head right was essentially a share in that mineral trust. You could not sell or buy a head right because the Osage wanted to keep it communally owned, the way they used to own their land. The only way you could get it was through inheritance. And so the only way you could get the oil money was through inheritance. And so what Hale had done was he had directed his nephew to marry into the family in a calculating plot that played out over years that required Ernest Burkhart to marry this woman, to sleep with her, to have children with her, while knowing that his uncle was systematically targeting them and the people Molly loved and most cared about. And it was not just this family.
There are a pair of local doctors that are implicated in all this, and it turns out that at the inquest into one of the execution-style killings, they don't find the bullet inside the skull.
No.
And the doctors are performing the autopsy out in the field with the panel, the inquest panel, yeah, around them.
Yeah, there's no exit wound, so they know the bullet is in the back of Molly's sister Anna Brown's head, and they do the autopsy out there, but nobody can find the bullet, and it becomes increasingly evident that the people carrying out the inquest are removed the bullet and removed the evidence. And one of the things that becomes clear to the investigators is that there are many conspirators. This is, and even they didn't quite get the breadth of it, but there was a great deal of complicity. These crimes required doctors often to administer poisons, morticians to cover up the crimes, reporters to neglect them, businessmen and guardians who were getting rich from them and stealing the money not to say anything or often to participate in them.
This is The Thread Live, coming to you from the Fitzgerald Theater. We're speaking with David Gran, author of Killers of the Flower Moon, and I'm Stephen Smith. So is Tom White, the gunslinger, or I should say the Texas Ranger, and the other FBI people, are they on to the sort of breadth of the conspiracy?
Yeah. So I should say, just in terms of the darkness, there is a lot of evil in this story, but there's also a lot of goodness. Molly Burkhart is somebody who has a great deal of courage in how she copes with this, how she crusades for justice, how she has to reckon with this truth. Tom White is also someone who is quietly good in his own way as well. The problem was Tom White eventually moves on to another job. Hoover prematurely closes the case. He wants to wrap this case up with a bow and use it to cement the Bureau's reputation, create his own mythology. Of course, he never gives any credit publicly to White and his men. And one of the great ironies is the only document I could find offering praise to the White and his undercover men was a tribal resolution issued by the Osage thanking them by name. Hoover would never do that. The case gets closed prematurely, partly because Hoover wants to wrap it up, also partly because it's easier in many ways to think of this crime as being committed by a singular evil figure like the King of the Osage Hills, and that if that singular evil figure is captured and purged, society returns to normal. But in truth, as I learned from speaking to the Osage, speaking to many of their descendants, and studying many of documents and records, you begin to realize that the breadth of the conspiracy was far greater. And this was a story much less about who did it, but who didn't do it, and that there was a culture of killing in which many people were marrying into families, both women and men, white and men and white women, and often targeting a single person within that family or even a child within that family, and that the death toll, what official death toll, was always more than 24, but in fact it was much more likely in the scores, if not hundreds.
And we'll get to that more in a moment. How did you come on to this story? How did you pick this thing up?
So I first heard about it from a historian in 2011, and I was shocked that this was something I had never learned about.
A historian where?
Interestingly enough, I co-called. I heard that the FBI had a historian within the institution. Hmm. And I literally co-called him, and I just said, I'm a writer. I'm always interested
in stories. Got any good stories?
And I literally said, are there any old cases that you... I was desperate to find a book subject. You know, things will make you cold call people. And I said, are there any old interesting cases that you think haven't been written about? And we talked about a bunch of different things and eventually mentioned the Osage case. I said, that's interesting. I never even heard of that. And I did a little research and I learned, you know, here the Osage were the wealthiest people in the world, a fact I had never heard of, that they had been mysteriously murdered that I had never heard of, and that this had become one of the FBI's first major homicide cases, another thing I'd never heard of. So I traveled out to Osage, the Osage Nation in northeast Oklahoma, still have a very vibrant nation. I visited the museum there, and when I was there, there was this panoramic photograph on the wall. It was taken in 1924. It showed white settlers along with members of the tribe gathered, and it looked very innocent, very innocuous. And I asked the museum, I noticed that on the photo, though, that a panel was missing. And I asked the museum director, you know, why was that panel gone? And she said it contained a figure so frightening that she had decided to remove it. And she then pointed to the missing panel, and she said the devil was standing right there. And she then went down into the basement, and she had a copy, an image of the missing panel, and she brought it up, and I looked at it. And there in the corner, peering out very creepily, was the King of the Osage Hills. And it was at that moment when I thought, here was something that the Osage had removed because they couldn't forget. And yet here was a story that so many Americans, including myself, shockingly knew nothing about. And that's really what set me on my way to try to write a book about this.
Can you give us a little bit of a taste of how you managed to pull that thread. Oh, excuse me. And yeah, it was really bad. and get to the story, you had to use all kinds of different archival materials.
Yes. So the first thing I did was I wrote letters to every institution I could think of that might be connected. Sheriff's Office, I did Freedom of Information Act requests to the FBI, to the Department of Department of Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, prisons, and to see what kind of archival records might exist, and began to get a slow stream of materials. I also went out to the National Archives as a branch in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of the records from Oklahoma would end up. And there, it looks like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like this enormous warehouse, and I could imagine like the Ark being tucked in the back. And you get there, and you'd have to pull at a certain hour, and they, you know, pull your box and bring it out.
Bring it on a cart.
Bring it on a cart and wheel it.
You have to sign for it.
Yeah. And I spent many weeks out there. I did more than one trip, and you know, often your eyes are just bleary-eyed looking at these bureaucratic documents or records, and you often don't see anything of relevance. And then occasionally you would open a folder, and there would be the secret grand jury testimony from the trials that, to the best of my knowledge, had never been made public. And that, unlike often trial records, for example, they had the voices of the people, because it's not just yes, no, yes, no. They actually speak in long paragraphs. Another document I found there was a book that had records of who were guardians and who were the Osages they were in charge.
It was like a ledger, right?
It was a ledger. And what was interesting is I had pulled it simply because originally, because I just wanted to check about a guardian, just wanted to check a guardian's name and who he had been in charge of. And when I was looking at it, I noticed that under many of the guardian's names, all it had was the guardian's name and then whatever Osage person they had overseen their finances. And one person, a bureaucrat, if the Osage had died, would just write next to their name, dead. And when you looked at many of the cases, you would see the word dead. And occasionally you might look at a guardian and you might see five Osage names and you see dead, 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 dead. And this was covering a very short span of time. It defied any natural death. And you begin to realize that you're looking at hints of a systematic murder campaign, and that somebody was noting it as if they were moving a merchandise. I mean, it was just this, you know,
it's a post facto hit list.
Yeah, yeah. It's just this antiseptic. And then what I would try to do was take those individuals. Some of them died of natural causes. It's important to point that out. You don't know. But you, when you investigate some of them, you know it's defying a natural death rate. And in many of those cases, you begin to find records where people at the time were complaining of a poisoning, of a mysterious death. You then interview the descendants, and you begin to learn that you are looking at a much larger, broader conspiracy than had previously been known.
I'm going to read just one paragraph from the book, which indicates the level of detail that you were able to get to. I'm not going to, well, I might put you on the spot and ask you how you did this, if you can remember. You did start working on this book, what, 5 years ago?
Yes, too long ago.
Who knows? When Ernest told Anna that her mama needed her, she promised to take a taxi straight there, and she arrived shortly afterward, dressed in bright red shoes, a skirt, and a matching Indian blanket. In her hand was an alligator purse. Before entering, she hastily combed her windblown hair and powdered her face. Molly noticed, however, that her gait was unsteady, her words slurred. Anna was drunk. Bright red shoes, alligator purse?
Yeah. So one of the things that happened with this case is the investigations went on from about... Molly first hired private investigators. And then you have 3 years of bureau investigations and 2 years of courts, various trials. And so almost everybody involved was interviewed multiple times. And so, for example, the chauffeur who drove her was interviewed and described Anna powdering her face. Ernest and all the people in the house described what Anna was wearing, down to the fact that Molly washed her clothes before she left that day. And in fact, that's one of the details that helps her to identify the corpse when it's found. She recognizes the clothes she had washed for her before she left.
So for a series of crimes that, you know, is not well known, there's this amazing level of documentation.
There is. And sometimes you have to know what you're looking at, like that ledger. And other documents were just hidden away, like the grand jury testimony. But because of there were so many investigations, if you look hard enough, and it's scattering, it took a long time, but you can find memoirs from some of the agents, you can find the PI reports. What was very helpful is that witnesses would be investigated, would be questioned multiple times. So you can cross-check and get better detail and also double-check that their memories are consistent.
So you have this moment or this period where you realize that the scope of the scheme, of the scandal, of the killing is much greater than had been expected and may reach into, certainly dozens, if not hundreds.
Yeah.
What did you do with that? How did you then try and advance that part of the story?
Yeah. So the Osage were extraordinarily helpful, and I could not have done this book without them, and I should stress that. When I came out there that first time to the museum and I met the museum director, we became friends. She was one of the first person who said to me, at one point she pulled me aside. She didn't want to tell me right away. And then at one point she pulled me aside and she said, my grandfather died under mysterious circumstances, and the wife, a white woman, made off with the money. Could you look into this? And then I would meet other Osage, and many of them had conducted their own investigations, trying to identify suspects, trying to gather circumstantial evidence, and they would point me in directions. And I would try my best to follow these trails of evidence to see if I was able to gather evidence. In one case, I spoke about the lawyer who had tried to gather evidence. He was a white man, but he was very close to the Osage. He was thrown off a speeding train once he was getting close to Hale. But the killers had never been identified in that case. And I tracked down his granddaughter, and they gave me the name of someone that the lawyer's wife had always had some tension with. And as I gathered more and more evidence and circumstantial evidence, it became pretty clear who was involved. And I say that with the proviso that the suspects are dead, and I want to be respectful of that. You can't ask them questions anymore. But I was able to find a lot of testimony. I was able to trace the money and where the money was going. I eventually called the granddaughter, and I told her what I had found, and she began to cry. And I felt very badly. I said, I'm really sorry. Part of me was like, should I not be telling her this, what I had found? And she said, no. We've been living with this for so long. And I realized then how living this history was for the descendants. And this was very true of the Osage as well. But one of the great tragedies is when you're chasing a story like this is that you're often chasing ghosts, and too many witnesses are gone. Too many trails of blood are washed away. And in many cases, you can't identify the perpetrators. History can often provide accountings for where there is an injustice, and I always thought of that as part of my responsibility. But one of the things I realized in this book is that the horror, I always thought of the horror of a crime as what you know. And by the end of the book, I started to realize that the horror is often what you don't know.
Mm. I'm going to leave, so that we don't have complete spoiler here, I'm going to leave the question of what happened to the king of the Osage Hills and some of the other folks that were implicated in the conspiracy. But I want to ask about Molly Burkhart. What happened to her?
So I found a document from Molly. I think it was from 1934, but it was around then, shortly before she died. She died relatively young. And of natural causes. But this document said that she had finally been deemed competent, which gave her, at long last, control over her money, her destiny, her rights, her life. She had only become a full-fledged citizen about two years before she died. She had... they had two children in that family, and who lived in that house of secrets. And I was able to track down Molly's granddaughter, a lovely woman named Margie Burkhart, who I got to know pretty well over the years. And she took me to many of the crime scenes. She described to me the suffering her father went through. And again, one of the things that...
The suffering that her father, who was...
A child in that house.
Right.
Whose own father...
Was part of the plot.
Was a perpetrator.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What's important to understand is you were living in a house with the victims and the perpetrator side by side. And when I spoke to her again, you just got a sense of this living history.
I want to talk about something slightly different. You wrote this week in Mother Jones about the demonstrations at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, another sort of oil story, Indians and oil story. And you say that there are echoes of the Osage terror in this fight over whether or not the pipeline should be able to go across part of the Standing Rock reservation.
Yeah. So I spoke to a few Osage about Standing Rock. There was a young man who is a Army veteran who served in Afghanistan, received a Purple Heart when he was shot in the knee. And during Standing Rock, he told me he had walked. He went on a pilgrimage from the Osage Nation, walking all the way to North Dakota to the plains.
With a bad leg.
With a bad leg. Towards the very end, he did hitch a ride because he wanted to get there in time for some stuff. But he walked most of the way. And during that quest, he told me he often thought about the Osage murders because the Osage know this history while the rest of us often don't. And he told me, and I also spoke to a former Osage chief, that obviously the issue of the particulars of Standing Rock is different. It's separated by nearly a century. The Sioux are not making money off oil. They're trying to protect their land and their environment and their water. But the fundamental issue is the same, they said, which is it about the rights of Native Americans and American Indians to protect their own resources and to control their land. And so I think that is where the echo is. And a former Osage chief I spoke to said, you know, I can't believe we're still having this fight today. There has been some murmurings from some administration officials about interest in trying to privatize reservations, which is, that is an extension of the simmering dream of William Hale.
I'm Stephen Smith. You're listening to The Thread Live at the Fitzgerald Theater with David Gran, author of Killers of the Flower Moon and of The Lost City of Z, which is out now in theaters as a major motion picture. And let's bring up the house lights and invite the audience to ask questions. We have two people who are wrangling the mics over here.
Can you tell us what the Osage community is like now, how they live?
And- sure. So there's a very vibrant nation. They have about, and my numbers maybe are a little off here, so loosely, about 4,000 Osage live in the area still. They have their own government. They have their own strong democratic institutions, their own legal. They have their own court system, judges. And about 20,000 people are citizens of the Osage Nation, have voting rights. The oil money has dissipated enormously. So much money was swindled during these crimes, a countless amount of money. And then the Depression came and wiped out a lot of fortunes. And also a lot of the oil has just simply been depleted. So someone like Osage still have head rights, or they would have a fraction of a head right. They may make a few $1,000s or even $40,000 a year, but they're not collecting millions. But they are a very strong, vibrant culture, very resilient. And when I speak to them, they've learned a lot from this history and taken measures to obviously prevent this kind of conspiracy. One of the things they did was to pass legislation that no headright could be inherited from someone who was not at least half Osage.
Have casinos filled in for
that? And casinos have provided a great deal of wealth and provided funding for education and health programs, which Margie Burkhart works in.
Over here.
So your stories are all over the map. There's giant squid, there's Sherlock Holmes, there's Indian reservations. How do you describe the thread that keeps them all together? What do you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was, we paid him for that.
You know, it's a really good question. The thing that compels me towards stories is curiosity. I am a quintessential generalist. I know almost nothing about the things I write about when I begin them, and it's a journey and a quest to learn about them. I try not to do the same thing again because I want to learn about something new. It's like I'm like the college kid who never grew up. And often there is some elements of obsession in the stories, people who are kind of driven and consumed. But I think in a way, the thing that connects them more than anything else, both my interest in the subjects, is people trying to make sense of the world and kind of the bewildering world in which we live in and the chaoticness of it, whether it's in science, whether it's in a crime. And I think that's also what drives me in a sense, is to try to bring some stability almost to the world around me and the chaos of the facts. That's a kind of maybe not a very good answer, but I think it is something that compels me when I get into the stories, which is to learn as much as possible about them and try to make sense of them. And many of the people I write about, like Molly Burkhart and Tom White, are living through history and trying to make sense of a very changing, bewildering world. I have a great deal of sympathy for people like that and interest in people like that. And I think of us all as investigators. I have a very broad sense of what a detective is. I'm less interested in necessarily just a pure professional detective. I'm more interested in Dr. Watson than Sherlock Holmes. I'm interested in people, ordinary people with frail human perceptions who struggle through life and hopefully try to make sense of it.
A man with a truly horrible job, David Graham. Thank you.
Thank you.